This is Kindergarten Cop, and it is Wednesday, July 1st, 2026. Today I will be reading from the Pantograph. I'm going to start out with an article titled Citizenship, a Birthright: Justices Block Trump Effort to Limit Right in Immigration Crackdown. The Supreme Court rejected President Donald Trump's attempt to restrict birthright citizenship in the United States, a right long woven into the fabric of American society, scuttling one of his top priorities in the crackdown on immigration. Tuesday's 6-3 ruling marked the second time this year that the court invalidated a major Trump initiative following its February decision to strike down his sweeping global tariffs. The justices upheld a lower court's decision that blocked Trump's executive order directing U.S. agencies not to recognize the citizenship of children born in the United States if neither parent is an American citizen or legal permanent resident, also called a green card holder. Challengers to Trump's order argued that it violates language in the U.S. Constitution's 14th Amendment that confers citizenship to those born in the United States who are subject to the jurisdiction thereof. Conservative Chief Justice John Roberts, who authored the decision, said Trump's directive violates language in the U.S. Constitution's 14th Amendment that guarantees citizenship to virtually anyone born in the United States, with a few narrow exceptions. Citizenship, then and now, was the right to have rights, to freely participate in our political community, adding that the authors of the 14th Amendment extended that promise to every freeborn person in the land. We keep that promise today, Roberts wrote. Trump, who repeatedly tests the limits of presidential power in domestic and foreign policy, issued the order last year on his first day back in office as part of a suite of policies to crack down on legal and illegal immigration. Critics accuse the Republican president of racial and religious discrimination in his approach to immigration. The challengers said the Supreme Court already settled the question of birthright citizenship in an 1898 case called United States v. Wong Kim Ark, which recognized that the 14th Amendment grants citizenship by birth on U.S. soil, including to the children of foreign nationals. Roberts pointed to that 1898 ruling. Not surprisingly, then, in the 128 years since, we have repeatedly understood the rule of Wong Kim Ark to guarantee citizenship to all children born in the United States and subject to its power, Roberts wrote. We see no reason to depart from that view today. Roberts said there was, quote, scant evidence to support the Trump administration's dramatically revisionist view of how to interpret the citizenship language of the 14th Amendment to limit birthright citizenship. If Congress intended to limit American citizenship to the children of those domiciled in the United States, nothing in the succinct language of the Citizenship Clause conveyed that design, Roberts wrote. Conservative Justice Brett Kavanaugh agreed with the ruling to reject Trump's directive, but disagreed with the rationale. He said in a concurring opinion that the order contravenes a separate federal law codifying birthright citizenship rights, but not the 14th Amendment itself. The Supreme Court weighed in on what it means to be an American citizen just ahead of the July 4th holiday, when the United States marks the 250th anniversary of its founding. Ahead of the ruling, some experts had estimated that Trump's directive could affect the legal status of as many as 250,000 babies born each year and could require the families of millions more to prove the citizenship status of their newborns. The legal challenge to Trump's directive, considered by the Supreme Court, which has a 6-3 conservative majority, involved a class action lawsuit filed in New Hampshire by parents and children whose citizenship was threatened by the directive. The 14th Amendment has long been interpreted as guaranteeing citizenship for babies born in the United States, with only narrow exceptions, such as the children of foreign diplomats or members of an enemy occupying force. The provision at issue, known as the Citizenship Clause, states, "All persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside." The administration has asserted that the phrase "subject to the jurisdiction thereof" means that being born in the United States is not enough for citizenship and excludes the babies of immigrants who are in the country illegally or whose presence is lawful but temporary, such as university students or those on work visas. Citizenship is granted only to the children of those whose primary allegiance is to the United States, including citizens and permanent residents, the administration has argued. Such allegiance is established through lawful domicile, which lawyers for the administration define as lawful permanent residence within a nation with intent to remain. When the Supreme Court considered the case on April 1st, Trump made history as the first sitting president to attend arguments before the top U.S. judicial body, though he left midway through, not long after the lawyer arguing against the administration began. The Supreme Court last year gave Trump an initial victory in the birthright citizenship context in a ruling restricting the power of federal judges to curb presidential policies nationwide. That decision, however, did not resolve the legality of Trump's directive. Democratic state's attorneys general, who had pursued their own legal challenge to Trump's birthright citizenship executive order, hailed the Supreme Court's decision. "Today's decision affirms a foundational tenet of American democracy, that every child born in this country, no matter their background, is equal under the law and can pursue the American dream," California Attorney General Rob Bonta said in a statement. New York Attorney General Letitia James, in a statement, called birthright citizenship a constitutional guarantee that has defined this nation for generations. Durbin, help dental students. Forgiving loans would expand care access, by Drew Zimmerman. Dr. Ann Keene was the first general dentist to join Chestnut Family Dental, which has provided care for underserved patients in Bloomington for the last 2 years. "We see patients every day who have had to wait several months for care or even go without treatment altogether because they simply don't have access, whether due to insurance limitations, workforce shortages, or gaps in service like sedation and surgical care," Keene said. Although she said she is happy and privileged to be in her role, Keene said there aren't as many dental students wanting to work in federal qualified health centers like Chestnut, which creates workforce shortages in communities with the greatest need. "That is a problem," U.S. Senator Dick Durbin, Democrat of Springfield, addressed Monday when he visited Chestnut Health Center, 702 West Chestnut Street, Bloomington, to meet with staff and speak on the issue. He said there has been debate in Washington, D.C. about eliminating federal student loan forgiveness programs for dental students, which would be devastating. "We should be expanding this program instead of fighting for its survival," Durbin said. "It is the answer to a real unmet need in this community." According to data from the Center for Disease Control and Prevention's National Center for Health Statistics, nearly 60 million Americans live in areas designated as having a shortage of dental health professionals as of March 2024. Durbin said he started looking into pediatric dentistry a few years ago and discovered that roughly 14% of dentists in the state treat at least one Medicaid patient a week. Keene, who spoke alongside Durbin, said a lack of dental care at early ages can impact overall health. "For children and adults, untreated dental problems can aggravate blood sugar levels in diabetic patients. Active decay is an infection, and a chronic infection for a long period of time could lead to sepsis or death," she added. I think we're seeing more advanced decay at a rapid rate in our pediatric population, but I think that's because we need more intervention. We need more preventative services, and we need more mobile programs in order to get to the schools, Keene said. After opening its doors in May 2024, Chestnut Family Dental saw 950 patients and arranged 2,156 visits. Of those patients, 76% were covered by Medicaid, 88% lived at or below 200% of federal poverty guidelines, and 16% were Spanish speaking. The following year, May 2025 to April 2026, it saw a total of 1,533 patients, 37% of whom were under the age of 20. Puneet Lika, CEO of Chestnut Health Systems, said at the event that he is proud of the progress that has been made in the stories of individuals who are no longer afraid to visit the dentist. However, far too many families in the community face long wait times and gaps to specialized services, he said. At Chestnut, we believe that oral health is an essential part of overall health, Lika said. That's why we've made a significant investment in expanding dental services as part of our integrated model of primary medical care, behavioral health, and substance use treatment. Durbin said representatives of Chestnut are in an uphill battle to attract doctors, dentists, and other health professionals. However, loan forgiveness for federal qualified health centers could improve the odds of recruitment and retention. If we go into dental schools and say we can virtually eliminate your debt if you provide some certain number of years of service, we can start bringing up more professionals on the ground, on the scene, Durbin said. Currently, Durbin said patients experience a four-month wait to visit Chestnut Family Dental. A specialized procedure like a root canal, meanwhile, could take 2 years to arrange. That's the reality of life for literally millions of people living in our state, he added. Pritzker signs bills on environmental standards in-state tuition by Ben Zielinski and Brendan Moore. Governor J.B. Pritzker has signed more than 60 bills since Friday, including new laws to increase transparency around rental fees and give some drivers an alternative to having their license suspended. House Bill 3564 bans so-called junk fees charged by landlords and adds new layers of transparency to rental agreements. The law, which takes effect January 1st, will prohibit landlords from levying fees or fines for a lease modification or renewal, an eviction notice, after-hours maintenance requests, and routine maintenance, among other common scenarios. It will also cap application and background check fees at $50 unless the actual cost of a third-party background check exceeds that. The landlord will then have to pay upfront and bill the applicant with a receipt displaying the third-party vendor cost within 14 days. Landlords must also include a list of all non-optional fees on the first page of the lease. Tenants aren't obligated to pay any fee that's not included. Those in violation of the law are subject to civil liability. House Bill 4472 requires the Secretary of State to establish a statewide blue envelope program. The voluntary program allows people on the autism spectrum to show a blue envelope to police officers that signals to the officer a person has a communication disorder. The envelope can house documents and includes instructions for both the officer and individual about how to handle the interaction. Many police departments around the country and throughout the state already participate in the program. The law takes effect January 1. House Bill 45 requires retailers to make digital coupons available to other customers through non-digital means. Coupons do not have to be provided in paper, but retailers must ensure the benefits are available to any qualifying customer. Lawmakers said they filed the bill after hearing concerns from customers about not being able to access digital savings. The law takes effect January 1. House Bill 4514 gives public utility customers the right to request a public forum to discuss rate hike proposals in front of the Illinois Commerce Commission, as well as the right to submit written feedback. It takes effect January 1. Until now, customer testimony hasn't been a protected part of the process, with speaking time limited to 3 minutes at ICC hearings and customers given no opportunity to submit written statements as part of the formal record. The new law also requires scheduling the forum on days and times to allow the greatest participation. House Bill 4420 enshrines the editorial independence of public radio and television stations affiliated with Illinois colleges and universities. The new law shields editors and reporters from prior review by university officials. It essentially is an extension of the protections already provided to student journalists. According to Illinois Public Broadcasting Council, 8 colleges and universities operate radio and television stations now covered by the law, which the organization says is the first of its kind in the nation. House Bill 4702 will require manufacturers of disposable and reusable diapers to include a list of all ingredients in order of predominance on the product packaging. The updated packaging will be required no later than July 2028. The goal, proponents say, is to allow families to identify potential allergens. The clear ingredient labeling, families will be better equipped to avoid products that may contain substances they prefer not to use and make informed decisions with confidence, said Senator Laura Fine, Democrat of Glenview. Illinois drivers who have their license suspended for speeding or reckless driving violations have an alternative under House Bill 4948. Drivers who have their licenses suspended for 2 infractions within a 12-month period for driving 26 miles per hour or more over the speed limit would be allowed to have a speed control device installed in their car rather than having their license suspended. The device is programmed to know the road speed limits and prevents the vehicle from driving any faster than it, no matter how hard the driver presses the gas pedal. It's similar to ignition interlock devices that people convicted of drunk driving must blow in to start their car. The law creates a pathway for high-risk drivers to remain connected to their communities while helping ensure our roads are safe for everyone. Bill sponsor Representative Marty Duder, Democrat of Elmhurst, said in a statement. The law will take effect in 2028. House Bill 5070 bars the Illinois Pollution Control Board from adopting U.S. Environmental Protection Agency rules and regulations that are less stringent than existing state standards. The board is generally required to adopt federal environmental regulations through an expedited rulemaking process when federal standards change, but the new law would prevent that in some cases amid a significant rollback of federal environmental protections initiated by President Donald Trump's administration. This will ensure Illinois maintains its strong environmental protections that are legally supported and based on sound science, said Illinois EPA Director James Jennings. More students could qualify for in-state tuition at Illinois colleges and universities under a new law. House Bill 5093 would loosen one of the requirements for paying in-state tuition by making it available to students who attended Illinois high schools for at least 3 years, even if they establish residency outside the state before enrolling. Non-citizens would have to begin the process of becoming a permanent U.S. resident to qualify. The change will take effect at the start of the 2027-28 school year. House Bill 5492 will require insurance providers to cover up to a 6-month prescription of hormone therapy. The law, one of 3 signed by Governor J.B. Pritzker ahead of the Chicago Pride Parade, will allow patients, especially those receiving gender-affirming care, access to needed medications. It comes as several Republican-led states and the Trump administration are increasingly restricting access to gender-affirming care. Advocates say that a longer supply will reduce interruptions in treatment. It takes effect January 1. Minor league baseball players are no longer subject to Illinois' minimum wage law under Senate Bill 454. The change only applies to players on the Peoria Chiefs, which is the only MILB team in Illinois as the High A affiliate for the St. Louis Cardinals. Representative Jay Hoffman, Democrat of Swansea, said Chiefs players are salaried and their wages are governed by a collective bargaining agreement. He said MLB and the players' union supported the bill and that state law already exempts other minor league players who play on unaffiliated teams. Pritzker also signed Senate Bill 3645, a bill pushing back the effective date or end of several laws, including a controversial bill to ban swipe fees that would have taken effect on July 1st. The Illinois law would have prohibited financial institutions from applying an interchange fee to the tax and tip portion of bills. Banks and retailers have estimated it would affect $120 million to $200 million in revenue or more each year, to the benefit of retailers and chagrin of banks. Illinois would be the only place where such a law was implemented. The law now won't take effect until at least July 1, 2027, after being delayed for two straight years. It may never take effect after a federal judge issued a permanent injunction against it earlier in June. Under Senate Bill 4006, insurers generally must send out cancellation and non-renewal notices 60 days in advance, double what was previously required. The law also requires insurers that offer fire and extended coverage that doesn't cover flood losses to explain that in plain language. They must also say whether the company offers flood coverage and how to obtain coverage through the National Flood Insurance Program. The insurer is required to obtain a signature from the insured affirming that flood coverage options were presented and declined. The law also requires insurers to participate in the National Association of Insurance Commissioners Climate Risk Disclosure Survey. Suspect charged, detained after man shot twice in Normal by Olivia Jacobs. A man accused of shooting another man at Gulf Crest Road in Normal less than 24 hours after he was arrested on DUI charges has been detained in jail. Maurice R. Delaney, 44, of Normal, appeared Monday afternoon before Judge Amy McFarland, who ordered he be detained in custody at the McLean County Jail. He was charged with the following: aggravated battery, discharging a firearm, Class 10 felony, aggravated discharge of a firearm occupied vehicle, Class 1 felony, two counts of unlawful possession of a weapon by a felon, Class 2 felonies, aggravated unlawful possession of a weapon by a felon, Class 2 felony, aggravated battery causing great bodily harm, Class 3 felony, invalid firearm owner's identification card, Class 3 felony. Normal police officers were dispatched to the 700 block of North Gulf Crest Road in Normal about 11:52 p.m. Thursday, June 25th, for a report of a person shot, said Assistant State Attorney David Fitt, who provided the probable cause statement to support the charges. A 911 caller indicated one male had shot another, Fitt said, adding the caller provided the name Reese at one point and said, "Why would Reese do that?" Upon arrival, officers found the male who had been shot being lowered to the ground by two women, Fitt said, and the officer saw his shirt was covered in blood. The male was found to have one gunshot wound above his navel and a second gunshot wound above his pelvis, Fitt said. While he was initially conscious and alert when officers cut off his clothing to view his injuries, he began to go in and out of consciousness while pressure was applied to his wounds, Fitt said. He was taken by ambulance to Carl Broman Medical Center in Normal for treatment. Witnesses told police they heard arguing followed by multiple gunshots, and they said the victim was shot by Reese, who was later identified as Delaney, Fitz said. One witness said the victim and defendant were talking about the previous night when Delaney was arrested by the Bloomington Police Department. Delaney was charged with driving under the influence and related misdemeanor and traffic charges. He also was suspected of possession of cocaine, which he said belonged to the victim, Fitz said. Delaney was not charged with the drug offense. Witnesses said the argument escalated and Delaney was punched in the face before drawing a gun and shooting the victim, Fitz said. Witnesses described the suspect and said he lived nearby. Police tracked Delaney in part by using license plate reader camera data, Fitz said. When police contacted Delaney, he had several bloodstains on his shirt and abrasions on his hands and knees, and an abrasion on his head as well as dried blood running down his face, Fitz said. Delaney, who lives in the 700th block of North Golfcrest Road, said his back and ribs were sore. He said he was inside the residence when he, quote, got jumped on by several people. He asked to be taken to a hospital for an evaluation, but was soon discharged back into police custody, Fitz said. Hospital staff told police the victim had two gunshot entry wounds, but no exit wounds, and both bullets were lodged in his pelvic area, Fitz said. One bullet was removed surgically, and one bullet was left in the victim's body. The victim was intubated and unable to speak while in the hospital, but nodded when police asked him if Delaney shot him, Fitz said. Delaney previously was convicted of felony, cocaine, and cannabis felonies, which make him ineligible to have a firearm owner's identification card. At the time of the shooting, the defendant also was on probation in McLean County for domestic battery, a Class A misdemeanor. Fitt told the court the gun has not been located despite a search warrant of the defendant's residence, which is another factor in considering him to be dangerous if released from custody. The fact that Delaney was arrested in the shooting less than 24 hours after his previous arrest also shows he would not follow orders if released. He should remain jailed, Fitt said. The defendant has denied he has a history of drug abuse or mental health issues, but the Office of Statewide Pretrial Services said his mother reported he has been diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia and depression for which he takes medication, Fitz said. He therefore likely would not be truthful in reporting to pretrial services, Fitz said. A pretrial risk assessment indicated Delaney had a 21.4% chance for a technical violation of any pretrial release order. Assistant Public Defender Stuart Wallace represented the defendant and asked the court to consider home confinement and electronic monitoring as opposed to jail, which is the most restrictive combination of conditions the court can impose, he said. He also asked the court to acknowledge the seriousness of the defendant's situation and that the defendant said the victim attacked him. He noted the defendant is employed full-time and has a minor child in the community. He said the assessment cited by the prosecution also showed he had a 78.6% chance of not violating pretrial restrictions. McFarland said the state proved by clear and convincing evidence that the defendant committed a detainable offense and poses a threat to the safety of the community. She said pulling out a gun and shooting, quote, is beyond the realm of what expectations are in a civilized society. Delaney is set for an arraignment at 9 a.m. July 24th.